Thank you. I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was happier in the meeting last night than I am in the meeting tonight, but I'm glad to be here. I want to thank Jay for extending an invitation to me. I wasn't quite so thrilled with the fact that he told my hostess that when she picked me up at the airport to look for the old hippie. kind of like offended me a little, but and all of you who have been so kind to me, people are really, really nice here. I don't know if it's something in the water or what, but I live on the other ocean, and so to be on the Atlantic Ocean was really very exciting to me. And I don't go to the beach on the other ocean because I've never quite understood the thrill of laying in the sand, sweating, and getting sand in your crotch. It's never I've never really been able to figure it out. But if you're on the other ocean, you have to kind of go in it anyway. And so I annoyed many of you by asking you to take my picture as I went in the water. And not only did we have to do it with my camera, but then we had to do it with my phone so I could get instant gratification sending it to somebody. And I had to do every, you know, I had to be in the ocean, I had to be in the pool. I don't swim, so it's like really difficult. I had to be in the pool, and I had to raft around on the little river, you'd think I was three. And I've just really had a good time, and people are really nice. Dave and his friends I've had breakfast with every, you know, both mornings, and people are very kind. They have absolutely no idea that I'm a thief and all kinds of other, I'm not even going to tell you specifically what else I am, but my story will disclose in a general way, and those of you who are bright are going to be able to pick up on some of it, but I really have no social skills. I've everything I know I've learned from the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how to behave. So I watch you, and then I go behave the way I've seen you behave. Some of you have been really poor examples, but I just kind of, I do what I see you do. And I was at an AA birthday party not too long ago, and it was at this woman's house, and she wasn't in recovery, it was for her son, and we went into the party, and I've seen you do this. You go into people's homes, and you go, oh, what a lovely home you have. So I did that. I walked in, and I said, oh, what a lovely home you have. And she said, well, would you like to look around? And I said, well, no, not really, because I shop. And she never left my side the entire time I was there. So I have no ability to be with you, and yet, you know, we come together like this, and we really, we have a really good time, and we're really kind and loving to one another. And how does that happen to somebody like me? I don't know how that happens to somebody like me, but I'm really thrilled with God's work. My home group is a very sick woman's meeting at 6 o'clock on Thursday evening at the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach. I attend it because I look very healthy there. And the book says when I do this, I should tell you in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like. Now, my sponsor always tells me, just tell him your name and tell him the truth. And I've told you my name. When I'm not so sure, I'm going to tell you the truth. And the reason for that is clear to me. I mean, I don't know about anybody else, but I never knew that what it used to be like was going to be important. If I would have known when I was out there that I was going to be here tonight reporting to you what it used to be like, I would have paid a lot more attention to my life. If I would have known I was going to have to report it, I would have probably taken notes. If I would have known about a fourth and fifth step, I can pretty much guarantee you I would not have done some of the things that I did. But I didn't know that it was going to be important, so I didn't pay a lot of attention. Coupled with that, I'm a blackout drinker. I love blackouts. There was nothing more exciting to me than leaving work on September 7th, going back on September 12th, and discovering I'd been there the entire time. It just makes the time between paychecks so much shorter. I love blackouts, but if you're a blackout drinker, it makes what it used to be like a little sketchy. And so a lot of what I report to you has been reported to me by other people, and I just have to assume they were telling me the truth. I have a job. I had to get a fingerprint clearance. I fingerprint really, really well. I know how to roll with the prints. I don't resist them. I don't roll ahead of them. I roll really well. But I didn't want to raise any red flags. So while the woman was printing me, I said very casually, well, how far back are you going to check? And she looked me in the eye and said, from the day you were born. And I thought, oh, my God, it's like a fifth step, only it's in the wrong order because they're going to know about it before I do. And the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says more will be revealed. It doesn't say how. So when my report came back, the woman called me. And you know how normal people, when they're going to give us what they think is bad news, they have kind of a hesitancy in their voice. And this woman had a hesitancy in her voice when she told me that my report had come back. And she said, you know, normally these reports are 2 or 3 pages long. And I said, uh-huh. She said, yours was 56 pages. And she asked me if I wanted to see it. Well, of course I did. And I can tell you this, I know a lot more about what it used to be like having read that report than I knew beforehand. So I don't know if this is true or not. I like the story, so I tell it, you know, and it may or may not be the truth. I didn't have my first drink of alcohol until I was 13 years old. I'm really sorry that I waited that long. But I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. I don't remember thinking much about alcohol. I don't remember thinking I would never drink. I certainly don't remember ever thinking I can't wait until I do drink. I just don't think I thought about alcohol at all. And yet when I was 13 years old, I was on a camping trip in Southern California. We were on the beach, and I remember when we got into the tent that Friday night, I had a bottle of vodka in my pillowcase. And to this day, I don't know where that bottle came from. I've always believed it was the grace of God, but I've never been able to confirm that. I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me, but I remember being excited about having it. And I asked if anybody wanted it, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it was all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, well, so what? And I took a top off, and I drank half the bottle, and I looked around the tent, and nothing had changed. Nothing had gotten different, so I drank the second half of the bottle, and that was to be the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never had resentments until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of my early resentments here was I heard you talk about your first drink, and you described the drink. And you talked about how it felt in your mouth, and you talked about this warmth in your mouth as it went down your throat. And you talked about it hitting your stomach, and it hit your stomach, and it exploded, and it went to your fingernails and your toenails, and you grew a couple inches taller, and your pimples fell off, and you dropped 20 pounds, and you became Prince Charles and Lady Di, and wonderful things happened to you, and that wasn't the case for me. I had my first drink of alcohol, and absolutely nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes. And at the end of the 15 minutes, the only thing that happened to me was I had to go to the bathroom. And it's my belief tonight that if you were to drink a quart of anything, in about 15 minutes, you would have to go to the bathroom. So I got out of the tent, and I shuffled down through the sand to the outhouse, and I went in and went to the bathroom. And when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely and totally 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I could not move. I couldn't even blink. I didn't feel my heart beating. And I was overcome with a sense of fear. And, of course, the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse. And there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Later in my drinking, I did discover that 2 people can use the same toilet at the same time if the second person is very careful about what they're doing. But it's a visual. It's a... But I didn't know that then. What I did know is I somehow knew that the body was made up of energy, and I somehow figured if I could gather my energy, I would be all right. So I guess it was my first formal meditation, because I sat and I gathered my energy. And when it seemed to be all in one place, when it seemed to be centrally located, I just sort of fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've discovered that my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. I could have this fantasy. I was in the Marines. I was being dive-bombed as I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. Now, in my own defense, I always have to tell you that my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And I think under those circumstances, it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did somehow manage to get back to the tent. I fell in and I passed out. And when I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared enough that I'd realized I'd been sick all night long. I'd hit like you've never been sick. I'd hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent, the floor. I hadn't missed a square inch, and quite frankly, I didn't want to be in the tent either, so I got out of there. And that was my first drink of alcohol, and it was the most wonderful, amazing, marvelous, magnificent, fabulous spiritual experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body from that day until the day I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I remember the day the guy at the market called me over and he said, "Patty, I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore." He says, "I can't believe anybody bakes as much as you do." And I got cut off from that supply. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I still have a weakness for, if you're wearing it, I may follow you too closely and laugh at your neck. One night, the women in my home group, kind and loving souls that they are, about 30 of them came in wearing Taboo one Thursday night. I went nuts. I was like spinning around. I kind of was like, ah! But, you know, and how do we know? I don't know how I know to do that, and I don't know that I'm living any different than anybody else. And when you think about it, really, how would we know? I mean, I don't know about anybody else, but I was a bar drinker. I was a living room drinker, an alley drinker, a car drinker, an office drinker, a dumpster drinker. I didn't specialize. I just drank. But I love bars. I love sleazy, nasty, disgusting bars. I like the ones with sawdust on the floor. I like them when the mirrors are cracked, so you kind of have to dip around to see yourself in there. The upholstery around the bar is ripped where people have tried to hold on as they're falling off their bar stool. And it's always nice if there's a piece of broken furniture in the corner somewhere. They used to be full of smoke. In California, you can't smoke in a bar anymore, which makes no sense to me. I used to drink in bars where guys would take a piss against the wall. Apparently, they can still do that, but they can't smoke in there. And we were talking about, this is how alcoholics at dinner were. This is our conversation at dinner tonight. I was talking about the guys at 6 o'clock in the morning that are 6:15 in the morning, they're standing outside those joints on the sidewalk smoking a cigarette. And, you know, you go by and it's like, "Would you get in there, please? You got urine on your pant leg, for God's sake. Get back in the bar." I mean, I know where, I used to be you, but there are nice people driving down the street. You know, and they're all out there smoking because they can't smoke in the bar. But they used to be full of smoke and they have that wonderful used booze urine smell that I salivate still. I love that smell. I mean, some days if I'm in a cranky mood, I'll stop by one of those joints, open the door, take a hit off of that, and it just perks me up for the rest of the day. But I'm fascinated by the quality of people who drank in those places. I mean, there were CEOs of really big companies. There were bank presidents, admirals in the Air Force, neurosurgeons. I mean, that's what they said they were, and I never... But we weren't sitting around having conversations like, "Well, what do you prefer, the red mouthwash or the green? Well, what's your preference, Chantilly or Aqua Velva?" We weren't having those kinds of conversations, so it doesn't occur to me I'm living any different than anybody else. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I don't know that at 13 years old I put alcohol into an alcoholic body, and from that day on I had no choice. I think I drink because I want to drink. I had an opportunity to go to college. I went to San Diego State. I am a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic. I'm drinking on a daily basis, and I'm a blackout drinker, and I graduated from San Diego State with a 3.8 grade point average. And I share that with you because it almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I got here, I told you I was too smart to be an alcoholic. Nobody with a 3.8 grade point average could possibly be an alcoholic. I stayed in San Diego and took classes for a master's degree. I'm one of those people, if I'm doing something well, I want to keep doing it, and apparently I do school well. So I stayed and took classes for a master's degree. I left San Diego because I had taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I have a disease that manifests itself in justification, rationalization, and denial. No matter what it is I do, I explain to you why I'm doing it. And as I'm explaining it to you, I'm hearing it. As I'm hearing it, I'm believing it. And I think I'm leaving San Diego because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I don't think I'm leaving because I have a roommate who's a little annoyed with me. I'm in a bar drinking one night, and some guy, if this offends you, I guess you deserve it. I don't know how else to say this, but the men who drank in the bars that I drank in had absolutely no creativity. They had two basic lines: "My wife doesn't understand, and I have no place to stay tonight." That was typically the end of their conversation. So some guy would come on to me with one of those lines, and even in the worst of my alcoholism, even as the most chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic, I had a tremendous amount of compassion. So some guy would come on to me with one of those lines, and I'd say, listen, I'll take you home with me, but I don't want to talk to you again until the bar closes. So the bar would close, being a lady of my word, I'd take this guy home with me, and we'd get to my house, and I'd send him into the bedroom on the right, and because I had to go to the bathroom, I'd send him into the bedroom on the right, and then I would go into my bedroom on the left, and I had just sent him in with my roommate. And now, some nights this would be okay with her. Some nights she wouldn't mind at all. Other nights, within a matter of minutes, there'd be all this banging on my door, which I'd locked my bedroom door. I had 7 o'clock classes. I had to get some sleep. But if it would have always been all right or never been all right, I'd have been okay. But she was so inconsistent, you'd have drank if you lived with her. And I don't think I'm leaving because she's annoyed with me. I think I'm leaving because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I don't think I'm leaving because I have one more drunk driving assault charge pending. And another resentment I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, I discovered here that you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I never knew that. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. And here's the thing. I'm driving down the street. The light comes on behind me. I pull over. The officer walks up. Now, the first thing I do is slam my car door open. Now, my intent is to knock him in the private parts. Men are a little fussy about their private parts. So as the door is flying open, he jumps back to protect himself. And when he jumps back, it's really a good thing because now he's far enough away that I can get him in focus. And I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try. And I go out the car for him. And it's a really good fight. Now, I was a lot younger then, but it was a really good fight for a couple of minutes. But I wouldn't remember that back at the car, he had a friend. And the friend had a radio. And the friend would call some more friends. And pretty soon be three or four of them, one of me. It's not fair, I say uncle, and they take me away. And the next time the light comes on behind me, I pull over, the officer walks up, I slam my car door open, try and knock him in the private parts, he jumps back to protect himself, he gets far enough away and get him in focus, and I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try, and I'd go for him. It'd be a good fight for a couple of minutes, but I wouldn't remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friends. Pretty soon, before five of them, one of me, it's not fair anymore, I say uncle, and they take me away. And I didn't do that once or twice. I did that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. I never remembered the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. And that's the insanity of my disease. The insanity of my disease is I do the same thing over and over, and I think the results are going to be different. This time I'm going to take him. This time it's a fair fight. And when you get out of the car like that, they attach an assault charge. They don't even care that they won the fight. Drunk driving assault, drunk driving assault. And I don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing, but I drank during the time where the state of California didn't get their underwear in such a knot about drunk driving. I understand they're really testy about it now, but I never had any consequences. They took my driver's license from me, but you don't really need that to drive a car. It just, but I'd call my attorney, I'd pay him $1,000, which was a lot of money. He'd write a letter, he'd make a phone call, whatever he'd do, and that'd be the end of it, and I'd never hear anything more about it. But one time my attorney was nervous because I had two pending at the same time. And if your attorney's nervous, I think you ought to worry about it. So I was sitting in a bar worrying about the fact that my attorney was nervous. And I started talking to this guy sitting next to me, and we struck up a conversation, and as luck would have it, he worked in a mortuary. And I came up with a plan. I think we as alcoholics come up with really good plans really quickly. And this was one of my better ones. We went over the mortuary. We got a death certificate. We put my name on it. We filled out all the pertinent information, we forged a doctor's signature, and we sent it to the court, because they can't expect a lot from you if you're dead. And I called my attorney, and I told him he didn't need to worry, and he didn't worry, I didn't worry, nobody worried for, I don't know, maybe a month or so. And then I got arrested for drunk driving assault. And and that time, the judge wanted to see me, and he never had wanted to see me. I couldn't figure out why he wanted to see me, but I went, and I'll never forget standing there and him looking down at me, and he said, Miss Ochoa, he said, tell me, how is it a dead person is standing in my court? And I shrugged my shoulders, and with all sincerity, I said, I don't know, bad luck. And And that's what I thought it was. It was bad luck. It was circumstances and conditions. It was the cops. It was you and they and them. It was a lot of things. Never occurred to me had anything to do with alcohol. Never occurred to me. So I loaded everything I owned into my car. I took two cases of beer, two bottles of booze, and I headed north. I'd been offered a job in Chico, California, which is as far north as you can get. I got 88 miles north of San Diego. I was out of booze, and I was thirsty. I pulled off the freeway. I have a sense I can find the sleaziest bar in town without even looking for it. I pulled into the parking lot of this place. I walked in. It was full of smoke. It had that wonderful used booze urine smell. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. That's as far north as I ever got, 88 miles from where I started from. Alcohol had become my mother, my father, my God, my friend, my lover, my companion, my support, and at some point it had turned, and I've always believed it was in the middle of my first drink. At some point it had turned and began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, dignity, decency, integrity, honesty, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings, and long before I got to you, it had taken it all. Long before I got to you, alcohol controlled every area of my life, where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from, and I didn't have a clue. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I went into the profession of my choice. I rose very quickly to the top, and that, too, almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I got here, I told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I told you about the trophies and the plaques. I was in the newspaper business, and we often gave awards, and I know tonight it was because God gave me a gift, but we often won awards. I didn't tell you about the time that I came out of a blackout standing behind a podium much like this in a room full of people holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I said, thank you, and I went and sat down, and then somebody elbowed me and told me, oh, I was presenting it to the Kiwanis Club, and I got up and had to start over again. And I didn't tell you about that. I just told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous with what I pray God was my last drunk driving assault charge. By the end, the state of California was starting to get really upset about people barreling down the freeway at 80 miles an hour, blowing something in the breathalyzer above their grade point average. And I was taking the field sobriety test that night. I was doing a good job. I even mentioned to the officer I thought I was doing A-plus work. And I'm the kind of person, when I get released from jail, I get the arrest report and I read it so I can find out where I made my mistake, so I can practice that part so that next time I'll get that part right. And you see, I always knew there'd be a next time because the cops were always looking for me. They knew what kind of car I drove. They knew what I drove if I had your car. They knew what I drove if I had a stolen car. They always knew what I drove, and they always were looking for me. And so I practiced field sobriety tests a lot. And when I prayed God was my last one, I knew by then, touch your finger to your nose means this. It doesn't mean that. I know how to walk. Tonight I can stand on 1 foot for 45 minutes. And at the end, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before I had responded with, well, I can't even do that sober. And then I had just confessed, and they took me away. So on the last one, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around, and I said, see, you think it's funny? He wasn't even amused. I was turned around, he put the cuffs on me, took me to Orange County Jail, and he put me in a cell with criminals. I mean, there were real criminals in there. There were prostitutes in there. There were burglars or women who'd been arrested for beating their husband, which I don't think should be a crime, but in California, they lock you up for it. And I knew I didn't belong there, so I tried to organize a prison break. And it was a simple plan, and I explained it very slowly to the criminals. And we're going to get our coffee cups, we're going to bang them on the bars. When the marshal comes to see what's going on, I'm throwing my arm around her neck. We're going to get her keys, and we're going to get out of here. I explained it very carefully and very slowly, and I heard something I was to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those criminals looked at me, and she said, why don't you sit down and shut up? And I said, fine, then y'all stay, but I'm getting out. And I was going like a mad woman on those bars. There's a couple problems with styrofoam cups. The first one is the bars have a tendency to eat them up. The second one is just a little bit painful. And when it got painful, I sat down and I shut up. I went to court on that charge. I was 26 years old. I had the public defender standing next to me because the day of the $1,000 attorneys was gone. And I was drunk in court that morning. And because the state of California was starting to get upset about drunk drivers, as a result of my past record, I was being sentenced to 10 years in prison. I had a 8-month-old son. I'm never wanted to be a mother. I found out that's not adequate birth control. I didn't like him much. He didn't do anything. He went and he cried. That's all he'd do. He wouldn't go get a job. He was really quite a nuisance. And And I didn't really like him very much, but I was willing to use him that morning. And I told the judge he couldn't put me in jail because I was a single parent and I was self-supporting through my own contributions. And he told me he would put my son in a foster home because I was an unfit mother. And I would have admitted to a lot of things. I knew I was a lot of things, but I did not believe I was an unfit mother. I had that kid with me every day of the week, whether he wanted to be with me or not. And he was to spend the first 11 months of his life in one of those plastic things that you put kids in when you don't want to touch him, on a pool table in a smoke-filled bar. But I thought because I had him with me made me a fit mother, and my son was going to a foster home and I was going to jail. And in the middle of sentencing me, the expression on the judge's face changed and the tone of his voice got different. And I know he was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because he looked at me and he said, I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance, and he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wish I can tell you that I took the alternative. I came here. I looked at the 12 steps. I knew there was a solution to problems in my life. I worked them all in the first week and skyrocketed to recovery. And if this wasn't being taped, I might tell you that story. But that's not my story. I stood in that courtroom and thought about it. Jail alternative. Jail alternative. I've been to jail. There's more drugs and alcohol in jail than there are some days on the street if you know what to do, who to do it to, and you're willing to go to any lengths, and I always was. Jail alternative. The public defender's putting his elbow in my ribs, and I'm trying to figure it out. And I had that morning what I know tonight is a moment of clarity, because trying to figure it out that morning, as drunk as I was, suddenly I knew clearer than I had known anything. And if I went to jail one more time, I would either die in the institution or I'd become institutionalized for life. And I didn't know why I knew it, but I knew it, and I took the alternative. And I left the courtroom and I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it had been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol. But I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what it was I was doing with the alternative he gave me, on that day I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know what ANA was. I thought it was something like the PTA or Parents Without Partners, and a lot of days it is, but I, as far as I know, I had never heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous before. I didn't know what you people were going to do to me or for me. I had absolutely no idea, and that first meeting was a speaker meeting, and I can't tell you who talked that night, but I heard 2 things. I heard, we don't drink between meetings. Well, I quickly looked around, and I didn't see any of you drinking in the meeting. And I thought, if you're not drinking in the meeting and you don't drink between the meetings, when do you drink? And I couldn't figure out why the judge sent me to a place where people didn't drink. I would have understood if he sent me to the Sears School of Safe Driving. I did not understand why he sent me to a place where people didn't drink. And the other thing I heard was that the answers were in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. And I can't tell you how irritated I was. I went home and read the book. Not only could I not find the answers in this book, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh, dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm going to have to go back and get the right one, and I'm a thief. Now, I don't know I'm a thief. I had to stay sober while my sponsor told me I'm a thief. I think it's important that you have a sponsor. I think it's critical you have a sponsor who's not as emotionally involved in your life as you are. It irritates me sometimes, but she has a whole different perspective on my life. And she tells me, here's the thing, I'm in a bar drinking, I find some keys, I go out and find the car that they fit, and I'm driving myself home. My sponsor in the San Diego police think this is Grand Theft Auto. I think it's alternative transportation. I just need to get home. Rationalization, justification, and denial. But I'm a thief, so it's humiliating for a thief to have stolen the wrong book. And I figure I'm going to have to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous to get the answer book. And I know about the answer book because I used to teach school. I don't like kids, but I like talking and I like writing on blackboards. And so when I was in college and I had to pay my way through college, one of the things I did was I taught school for a very short period of time. Gratefully, there's only about 30, no, they're about 40 years old now, young men and women who are illiterate. But I like writing on the blackboard and I like talking. And I'm not the kind of teacher that waits till 3:30 in the afternoon to have a drink. I have a bottle in my, if you're teaching 7-year-olds, you have got to drink all day long. I got a bottle in my desk drawer. I'm taking a hit off of that bottle quite regularly during the day. And I'm writing and I'm talking. I'm having a good time. I accidentally one day turned too much and caught the class out of the corner of my eye, which really annoyed me because I lost my train of thought. And this little kid's jumping up out of his chair. You know how they are. They're just, I mean, now we call it attention deficit disorder. Then we just called it a nuisance. But he's up and down his chair. And I said, Johnny, what is it? What do you want? He said, Mr. Joey, you spelled mountain wrong. Now, I'm a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic, only I don't know it. And I don't have to take a breath to explain to you why I did something. And I said, Johnny, now that's very good. Now, I'd like the rest of the class to see what Johnny's done. Because Johnny's paying attention, he found the word that I spelled incorrectly. Every once in a while, I'm going to spell a word wrong just to see if you're paying attention. So I put Johnny's name on the board, and I put a star after his name. We all want stars after. I had 30 kids on the edge of their seat from 8:30 in the morning until 3:30 in the afternoon to find the words that I spelled incorrectly, and I just didn't ever look at them again. But because I had that experience, I knew about the answer book. So I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to get the answer book. I don't think it matters why you come back. I don't think it matters what your motives are, what your intentions are. I think what's important is what your actions are. Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I came to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a small discussion meeting. And in that meeting, I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. I mean, look at the person next to you, unless you're sleeping with them. What is it? I mean, I couldn't figure it out. And then I saw him. And I truly believe there's a him for each of us. This guy was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants. Now, I don't know about Myrtle Beach, but in Southern California, I work with adolescents, which is kind of like my penance for life. But I work with kids who wear pants that have absolutely no relationship to their body size. They wear pants that are so big they could put a homeless family in there with them. And I ask them why. They tell me it's comfortable. I said, your crotch is dragging on the floor. How can that be comfortable? But his weren't that baggy, but they were baggy. He had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, but the holes were there where they should have been, and he nodded out during the meeting. And I quickly assessed the situation. I figured he was shooting heroin. Folks who shoot heroin nod out. And I could probably do this thing and not drink if I can shoot a little heroin. So I found out where he worked. The next day I snuck down to his office and I said, Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it. And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink, so I guarantee you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my family life would get better, my relationships would get better, my finances would get better, my job life would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. It's a little hope for the newcomer, but but I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I've never had it so good. You see, I don't know good from bad for me. I'm going through something that I think is good for me, and it generally turns out to be bad for me. And I'm going through something I think is bad for me, and it generally turns out to be good for me. And I don't know good from bad for me. I've gone through times in the last 30 years that have been incredibly painful. I've gone through times that have been disappointing. I've gone through horrible, hideous hurts. And I'm kind of dramatic, so I always refer to it as the dark night of the soul. Unless, of course, you're going through it, then I just tell you to get over yourself. But but in those times, if I don't drink and don't die and don't drink and don't die, I've gotten far enough beyond it to look back in retrospect and see that every time I thought my life was falling apart, what was really happening is it was falling together. And it had to be exactly that way for God to move me to where he'd have me be. You see, I don't move easily. I get real content with right here, right now. Right here, right now, my life is perfect. My life is ideal. I've got way more than I ever deserve. Well, what I deserve is 2 days in the electric chair. But I've gotten so much more than I could imagine for myself. So I like dig this little rut, and I get comfortable, and I decorate it. And then for God to move me to where he'd have me be, sometimes he has to give me a little kick in the butt to move me to where he'd have me be. And sometimes that kick in the butt is painful. So every area of my life is different than it was the day I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never had it so good. Now, my perception, and this might not even be true either, but my perception is people hurt me all my life. My perception is people hurt me and they disappointed me. My parents told me they loved me anymore, their love and I'd have died. Their love was physically, emotionally, and mentally abusive. I came to believe as a small child that if I loved you, I had to hurt you. And if you loved me, you were going to hurt me. And I learned as a kid that I didn't need you. I couldn't depend on you. That if I couldn't do it, it didn't need to be done. And as a small child, I began to build a wall between me and you. I built a huge brick wall between me and you because I just don't want to be hurt anymore. And I lived behind that wall in isolation and loneliness. And alcohol didn't allow me to come out and play. Alcohol just made it okay for me to be back there. But when you live behind a wall like that, you don't believe and you don't trust. And I hadn't believed another human being in a very long time. But that morning, I believed that old man. And I didn't know why then, but I know why tonight. I believe that old man because of the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. One alcoholic talking to another. One alcoholic talking to another goes through that brick wall. And I believe that old man. I already had the book, so every night I'd open it to chapter 3 and I'd read the line that says, most of us are unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. I'd say amen and close the book. And that was reading the book. I'd go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach where they have AA meetings. I'd have a cup of coffee on the way out. I'd say hi, Jim, to the manager. He'd say hi, Patty. That was talking to another alcoholic. My court program said I had to go to 2 meetings a week. I thought that was really obsessive, but I was willing to go to any lengths to stay out of jail. So I went to the 2 meetings a week my court program said I had to go to, and the only thing I did right is I didn't drink. And I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink. And I pray God happens to everybody who's new what happened to me. I've been in a lot of pain in the last 30 years. Sometimes life was painful. I don't know why. I made this up. I make up a lot of stuff, by the way. I made this up with no input from anybody, but I made up this idea that if I worked the steps really, really hard with enough passion, if I really, really, really worked the steps, that I would somehow float above human. I would somehow float up here where I never had a feeling that I judged as negative. I would just always be happy, happy, happy. I'd always have a parking place in front of May Company. Life would be really good. What I've come to find in taking the steps is I've come into my humanness. And sometimes as a human being, life is painful. And I've been in pain in the last 30 years, but I have never been in the kind of pain that I was in 8.5 months away from my last drink. 8.5 months away from my last drink. No alcohol and no recovery. No alcohol and no recovery is the greatest pain I've ever been in. And 8.5 months away from my last drink, that pain drove me to my knees. And on my knees, I took the first step of recovering Alcoholics Anonymous. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, that whenever I do battle with alcohol, I lose. Whenever I get into the ring with alcohol, whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it, whenever I get into the ring with alcohol, I lose. And my life had become unmanageable. Alcohol controlled every area of my life. And my life had become unmanageable. And that day, I took the first step of recovering Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety was a gift from a very gentle and a very loving God. I was given the gift of sobriety on a day that I didn't look for it, I didn't ask for it, I didn't want it. And yet on October 4th, 1975, a very gentle and a very loving God gave me the gift of sobriety. And 8.5 months later, I chose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just my opinion. The book says these are the steps we took which are suggested as a program of recovery. My opinion is once I chose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, I am required to work the steps exactly the way they're written in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to tell you that I did that in the next week. But the truth is, for me, I have never taken any of the steps till my back was against the wall. The pain was so great it was do it or die, and I had no other choice. And under those circumstances, I become very willing to look at the next one of the 12 steps to recovering Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to spend a few minutes talking about the steps because, for me, this is what happened. I believe we all have the same story. We just acted it out a little bit differently. But the what happened for me is the 12 steps to recovering Alcoholics Anonymous. There was no way to get from where I was on October 4th, 1975, to where I am tonight, except through the power and the magic of the 12 steps. And this is just my experience. If you have another experience, it's your experience. But I'm a loner by nature. Left to my own devices, I prefer to be by myself. I am great company for me. I may be a little boring for you, but I am great company for me. I like to do things by myself. I like to fish. Well, I like to throw and reel. I'm not big on catching because then you have to touch them, and they're really kind of nasty. But I like throwing and reeling a lot. I like to read. I like to be my. I really, really, my favorite thing to do is sit on my couch and watch reruns of Special Victims Unit. I'm a loner by nature. Alcoholics Anonymous didn't change my nature, but what you've done is you've given me the courage and strength to do the things I need to do in spite of my nature. The book talks about we become disgustingly, even dangerously antisocial. I didn't become that way. I started out that way. I have in the last 30 years acquired one social skill. However, I used it about 11 o'clock this morning, so I'm fresh out. The most difficult thing for me to do is to be with you. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength to continue to choose to recover. Cowards drink. I know that because I did that for 13 years. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength to continue to choose to recover, and I don't have it. But I come here, and when we pray tonight, the person on my right will give me a little strength, and the person on my left will give me a little courage, and you give me the courage and strength that I need to continue to choose to recover. But I'm still, by my nature, I'm a loner. I used to say I had no problem with God, but the truth is I have one problem with God. I believe we are all God's children, and I've always wanted to be an only child. That's the only problem I have with God. But for me, in step two, the power greater than myself was not God. You see, because as a loner, if I had come to believe that God was going to restore me to sanity, I'd have sat on my couch. God would have flown by, sprinkled me with sanity, take off to wherever it is God hangs out, and that would have been the end of it. I would have never had to do another thing. I would be home in Southern California watching reruns of Special Victims Unit, and somebody else would be here sharing with you, because I would have never had to do another thing. So for me, the power greater than myself in step two was the action of steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I came to believe that through taking the action, the steps, I could act my way into right thinking. So I spent my whole life trying to think my way into right living, and that has never worked for me. But through taking the actions, the steps, I have been able to act my way into right thinking. I hear in California all the time we tell newcomers, don't think. I don't know how you do that. I think all the time. I'm talking to you, I'm thinking about something else. Then I start thinking about the fact that I'm thinking. Then I start thinking I shouldn't be thinking what I'm thinking while I'm thinking what I'm thinking that I shouldn't be thinking. And then I try not to think what I'm thinking while I'm thinking what I'm thinking what I shouldn't be thinking while I'm thinking. And I'm just great. I'll tell you what, I'm grateful. I'm grateful I don't have a loudspeaker on my head so that everything I thought came barreling out. That would be truly humiliating. But I think all the time. And what's happened as a result of taking the steps is I have been able to act my way into right thinking. I'm an alcoholic. I will always be an alcoholic. Every once in a while I have a thought that a drink would be nice. It's a big drink, but a drink would be nice. When I have that thought, I just clap. I say, thank you for your participation. I just go about whatever it is that I'm doing, and I don't have to take an action on it. Step three for me, I often ask people what step they're on. They go, oh, I'm on the third step. You know, every day I get up and I turn my will and my life over the care of God. But by about noon, I take it back. Well, I'm on the third step. I turn my will and my life over the care of God, except for my sex and finances, because I don't want to be poor and celibate. And I pretty much stay away from them because I don't think they understand the step. I've had the same job now for 15 years, and I drive the same way to work. I go up Chapman Avenue in Orange, and I'm coming to the intersection at Schaefer, and I have to make a decision, turn right, turn left, or go straight. To get to my job, I got to turn right and make a decision, turn right, and I go straight through the intersection. So I make a U-turn. I head back toward the intersection. I got to make a decision, turn right, turn left, or go straight. Now to get to my job, I got to turn left. I make a decision, turn left, and I go straight through the intersection. Now I make another U-turn, and I start swearing. And I head back toward the intersection, got to make a decision. To get to my job, I got to turn right and make a decision, turn right, and I go straight through the intersection. Now I am really swearing as I make another U-turn. I head back toward the thing, and that's got to turn left. To get to my job, I make a decision, turn left, I take the steering wheel, and I do this. And the book talks about it. It says something to the effect that although our decision was vital, it had very little permanent effect unless immediately followed by action. The decision I make in my car has no impact on my car. What has an impact on my car is turning the steering wheel. The decision they're asking me to make in step three, although important, how do you want to live? Chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic, or do you want to believe the people in AA are telling you the truth? Despair, hope. Despair, it's not a tough decision. I think I'll go with hope. But the decision has no impact unless immediately followed by action. And, of course, the first right action for me was the fourth step. And I did my inventory the way the book says to do. I made the columns. I wrote down everybody who I resented, which basically turned out to be everybody who breathed air that I thought should have been mine. Wrote down in the second column what they did to me. Well, I wanted to tell you all my life what they did to me. I was really excited and sorry I waited this long to do this, and I was really having a good time. Third column, how it affected me. Well, it affected my security, my self-worth, my... Well, no wonder I drank. If all these people did all these things to you, you'd have drank too. And I was really having fun doing this inventory thing until I accidentally turned the page of the big book. And after it shows the diagram hidden in the body of the text, it says something to the effect of referring to our list again, we put out of our minds the wrongs others had done, and we looked at our part. Well, it took the fun out of it, but I did that. And I did that with my resentments, my fears, and my relationships. And for the first time, I saw who Patio really was. You see, I spent my whole life putting on a show for you. Rationalization, justification, and denial. And as I explained it to you, I heard it. As I heard it, I believed it. And I spent my whole life putting on a show. When I did my fourth step, I saw who I really was. And then I looked at the fifth step, and I thought it was probably for those of you who weren't raised Catholic. I was raised Catholic. I know about confession. I know it doesn't work. And I figured doing this fifth step would give the rest of you the experience that we Catholics already had. And so I put my fourth step in the trunk of my car because I didn't want anybody finding it, and I drove around with a continual sense of impending doom. And, of course, the fear was I was going to be rear-ended on the freeway, my trunk would fly open, my fourth step would be everywhere, and rather than do a fifth step, I drove that way for a really long time. And then one night I was in Los Angeles visiting somebody. We were talking. As we were talking, I realized I was doing my fifth step. And I truly believe God will put the person in front of me with whom I'm to share. Because I started doing my fifth step with this woman. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it right. I went to my car and I got my fourth step and I did my fifth step with her. And when I finished that big brick wall that I had built between me and you, one brick came out of that wall. One lousy brick. But every time I've shared with another alcoholic, another brick has come out of that wall. And tonight I have no brick wall between me and you. Well, I have a little styrofoam thing I throw up sometimes because sometimes I get afraid. Sometimes I feel insecure. Sometimes I have self-doubt and you're not there. And I throw up a little styrofoam wall. And then one of you comes and blows on it, takes my hand and walks with me. And you open new doors and you add to my life. I went home from doing my fifth step. I did step 6 and 7 by mistake. I didn't mean to recover this quickly, but I just accidentally turned the book to the part where it talks about step 6 and 7. And you don't have to be a journalist to know this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is written very poorly. Any newcomer will tell you. But the part about step 6 and 7 gets kind of poetic, and I got lulled into reading it. And when I became aware of what I was reading, I was in the middle of the seven-step prayer. And when I became aware of what I was reading, that prayer took the longest journey anything's ever taken for me, the journey from my head to my heart. And I knew that I believed it. And I finished reading that prayer. And what a cool prayer that prayer is. Take all of me, good and bad. For the first time in my life, I don't have to make a judgment. I don't have to decide if it's a good thing or if it's a bad thing. Take it all, good or bad. Just leave me what I need to be of service to you and my fellows. And what it says in the book happened to me, I walked through the archway to freedom. I walked away from the person I've been all of my life to start to become the person God intended for me to be. And I believe that's the miracle here. We tell newcomers don't leave before the miracle happens, and then we don't tell them what the miracle is. I believe the miracle here is that we have an opportunity to walk away from the person we've been all of our life to start to become the person God intended for us to be. And I'm afraid too many people leave before they give themselves that chance. As a result of the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous sharing with me how you live life. You have shared with me how to be a daughter and not take a drink, how to be a mother and not take a drink, how to be an employee and not take a drink, because you've been willing to share your life with me. I have become very kind, very loving, very passionate, very caring, very concerning. And all of the things that I was always so afraid of, I believe I am becoming the person God intended for me to be. I love the woman who I am. I'm tempted to write a book, Women Who Love Themselves Too Much. Steps 8 and 9 for me were conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I felt guilty because I was guilty. I did a lot of things to a lot of people for one more drink. If it came between you and a drink, I took a drink. A job and a drink, I took a drink. The only thing I wanted to do since I was in the fourth grade was be a writer. I had an opportunity to go into that profession. I gave it up for one more drink. If it came between you and a drink, I took a drink. And the amends weren't just about saying sorry. They were about living my life differently. I said sorry all my life, sorry, 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 and then I do it again and I get caught. Sorry, 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 and I do it again and get caught. So it wasn't just about saying sorry. It was about living my life differently. And I became willing to make amends to everybody in my life except my father. I hate my father. My father's a Jekyll and Hyde drunk, and I was a target of his abuse, and I hate him. And I told my sponsor I wouldn't make amends to him, and she said, that's fine, but you have to be willing to pay the price. And I said, oh, that's great. I don't want to go to the father-daughter banquet. I don't care about that. And I refused to make amends to him, but I began to make amends in the rest of the areas of my life. And I was sober 5 or 6 years, I guess. And I suddenly looked around Alcoholics Anonymous, and I realized that y'all were doing more than coming to meetings. I saw people before the meeting in little groups talking. I saw people after the meeting talking. I heard you talking about going to dinner and going to the movies. And I decided, you know what, I want a friend. You know, I had never had friends in my life. And I thought it was by my choice. I thought I chose to never have friends because friends are a nuisance. They get in your way. They want stuff from you. They ask you things like, hey, where were you last night? You know, if I wanted you to know, I'd have told you before I went. You know, they're just... And I think I don't have friends because I don't want friends. And now suddenly I'm 5 or 6 years sober and I decide that I want to have friends. So this is how I make friends. I sit next to you during the meeting. And then the next meeting, I sit next to you, and then by the third meeting, you're my friend. And I'm very excited because now I have a friend. But then you do something to annoy me, like crack your gum, and now you can't be my friend anymore. So Now I have to have another friend. So I sit next to somebody else for a meeting and two or three, and now they're my friend, and I'm very excited because they're my friend. And then they do something to annoy me, like they kick me while they're crossing their legs or something. Now you can't be my friend either, and I need another friend. And I sit next to somebody else for two or three meetings, and then they're my friend. I'm very excited about my friend until you do something to slight me, like go to get a cup of coffee and you don't bring me one. And now you can't be my friend either. And I mean, look at this. AA is huge. You can do this for a really long time. And I'm like, then one day I'm chatting with my sponsor, and you know, you got to say things to fill the air. And so I'm like chatting it up with her, and I just happened to mention that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous don't know how to be friends. And she says, wait a minute, say that again. And so I'm telling her about how people are, you know, they just don't know how to be friends. And she said, Patty, remember that you wouldn't make amends to your father? And I said, absolutely. And she said, Patty, hate doesn't know that it's directed at one person. When you hate, that will spill out into every other relationship in your life. I became willing to make amends to my father, not because I wanted to go to the father-daughter banquet. I became willing to make amends to my father because I wanted to have relationships with you. I don't think it matters what your motive is. I think it matters what your actions are. And I began to be a good daughter. And in being a good daughter, I started cultivating friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my dearest friend, we talked in the book about we are people who normally would not mix. My dearest friend in Alcoholics Anonymous was a woman who we are people who normally would not mix. I used to refer to her as the princess. She called me the medicine woman. I thought self-supporting through your own contributions means going to work. She thinks it's alimony. We would go to an AA convention together. I would take a backpack. She'd have 5 foot lockers because she had to do several costume changes. We are people who normally would not mix, but what we had in common was a passion for Alcoholics Anonymous. We were both in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Cindy Martindale was my friend, for my best friend for 18 years, and then one October she was diagnosed with breast cancer metastasized in the liver, and on October 27th, it will be 5 years that she died, and I had the privilege of being with her the last 6 weeks of her life, and I was with her when she took her last breath, and I spent the last 20 minutes in her room with her telling her that it was going to be okay, that she needed to let go, and that we would be okay. And when she took her last breath, I fell to my knees in her room and thought I couldn't go on. You see, I'm the kid. I built the brick wall to keep you out because I don't want to be hurt anymore. I just built the brick wall to keep because I just don't want to be hurt. And one by one, the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous helped me to take those bricks down. And that morning, I was in more pain than I thought I could stand. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I absolutely did not think I could go on, but I have been trained. My feet have been trained in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my feet took me to a meeting that night at the Canyon Club. And my feet have continued to take me to a meeting. And I keep trying to put that wall up, and the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous, you come and knock that wall down, and you have not let me build that brick wall back up. And I continue to do the things that you've asked me to do, and I've continued to do the things that I've learned how to do. And although it is still very painful, and although I miss the princess deeply, men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous have walked back into my heart. I have the book talks about when you've gone the 12-step call. If the man or woman doesn't respond, don't neglect the family. And I was taught that in the beginning, and I have done that. And I went on a 12-step call not too long ago, and the woman did not get sober, but I stayed connected to the family. And not too long ago, the sister called me up, and her sister was drunk, locked in her room, and wasn't responding to a knock on the door. So I went to the house, and I knock on the door, knock, 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 and nobody responded. So I looked at the door. Now, I've seen a lot of TV. And on TV, they run into the door, they hit the door falls in, you're on the floor, and it's a little embarrassing, but you're in the room. And so now, for those of you who are downstairs and can't see me, I'm not a huge woman, but I've seen this happen over and over and over on TV, and I didn't have a lot of room, but I bought 2 steps back. I take 2 steps back, and I run to that door, and I slam into the door. Now on TV, the door goes bloop and you're in the room. In real life, the door goes bloop and it shoots you back to where you started from. Now I got shot back to where I started from and it pissed me off. So I look at the door and I'm thinking, one of it, one of me, and I hit it again, and I hit it again, and I hit it again. And it kept throwing about the fourth time, it threw me back inside the room. This voice goes, what in the hell do you want? And and that woman walked into my heart. And that's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. We walk into each other's hearts. And as you walk into my heart, you add to my life. As you walk into my heart, you allow me to love you, and you begin to love me. And we begin to heal one another. We heal one another from the hideousness of alcoholism. We heal one another from the isolation, loneliness, and the despair, and the desperation, and the incomprehensible demoralization. We begin to heal one another here. This is where it happens. I'm going to tell you really quickly because I'm almost out of town. I mean, I am out of town, but I'm also almost out of time, too, while I'm out of town. Although in California it's only 6 o'clock, so I've got another couple of hours. My son was 11 months old when I got sober, and I brought him with me to Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't know what to do with him. And I brought him with me, and I would bring him to a meeting. One of you would hold him, and you'd bounce him, and you'd whatever you do with him. And at the end of the meeting, you'd give him back to me. And I'd bring him to the next meeting, and you'd take him, and you'd love him. And everything my son knows, he learned from the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous. He learned him how to be, taught him how to be kind and loving and gentle. He taught him how to care. You've also taught him how to con and manipulate, and I've never been thrilled with that. But everything my son knows, he's learned from the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous. And just sitting in a meeting were enough. My son would have never had a problem. But just sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is not enough. You have to do the work. And my son had a journey that he had to go on, a journey of alcoholism. He went to places where men and women shouldn't have to go, and he did things that men and women should not have to do. And I was in the ring with him. He was in San Francisco, and he called me, and he told me he'd fallen, and he'd gotten his cut in his head, and he had to go have stitches. And it was going to cost $120. And I said, well, give me the address and I'll send you a check. He said, oh, no, they've got to have cash. I said, well, I don't know how to do that. So he taught me how to wire money. And I wired him money. And a few weeks later, he called me and he'd had another accident. And I wired him money. And a few weeks later, he had another accident. And I wired him money. And pretty soon, I had 3 or 4 MoneyGram places going because I didn't want to go to the same guy every time. And I had different stories, and I was in the ring with his disease. And whenever I'm in the ring with alcoholism, I'm going to lose, whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. And I was in the ring with his disease, and I was doing everything wrong. And I was sober. I was sober 26 years, and I was doing everything wrong. The thing that I did right is I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I told you the truth. I told you that I was sending him money. I told you what I was doing. And every time I did it, I came here, and I told the truth. And God bless the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous who took me aside after meetings and said, Patty, aren't you embarrassed to be sharing that stuff? And you know what? If I can't come here and tell you the truth because I'm afraid of being embarrassed, I'm going to be out there drunk. I would rather come here and risk being embarrassed than be out there drunk. And so I kept coming here and telling you the truth. My son moved back to Southern California, and one day he called me up and he said, Mom, I need help. And God will do for me what I can't do for myself. God won't send me money in the mail because I'm able to go to work. But God will do for me what I can't do for myself. Because my son called me that morning and said, Mom, I need help. These words came out of my mouth, and I would not have said these words to my son. I love this boy more than life. I said, Patrick, I can't help you. If I come, I'm going to kill you. You need to stay where you are. And I called a man. I called a high-profile member of Alcoholics Anonymous because maybe he's going to 12-step my son. It's going to be a high-profile member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he wasn't home, and so I called a goof. I called the guy who knew the traditions. And he didn't say, have the kid call me. He said, where is he? And I gave him the address, and he went and picked up a newcomer, and they went and got my son out of that motel room, and they brought him to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he brought him to the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he did with him what you have done with me. He didn't tell him what to do. He showed him what to do. He didn't tell him to stand at a door and greet. He stood at the door and greeted with him. He didn't tell him to read the book. He sat and read the book with him. And he showed him what to do. And for years I'd been telling my son, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he would say, I'm not going to be Patio's son. And I'm a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I kept saying, Patrick, trust me, there are people in San Francisco who have never heard of me. And that was his rationalization. That was his justification. I will not be Patio's son. And my son came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he sat in the middle of you, and he began to do the things that we do. And he was sober, I don't know, 8 or 9 or 10 months, and very active. And a young kid came up to me one night at a meeting, and he said, "Are you Pat O's mother?" And I went and found my son. I said, "I will not be Pat O's mother." And if he doesn't drink and he doesn't die, he'll be 4 years sober the 23rd of October. And it is the second most important date of my life. And at the end of November, I'm going to be a grandmother. And so I'm Patio tonight. At the end of November, I'll be Granny-O. But, and we are all very excited about it. We have started the treatment fund, but we are all very excited. Step 10 says continue the process. Keep writing about it, talking about it. Ask God to remove the defect, make amends if necessary, and then turn your attention to somebody you can help. And I want to share with you my 11th step. My prayer in the morning is very simply, "Thy will be done." My prayer at night is a little scarier, and offered to anybody who'd like to use it. My prayer at night is, "Dear God, please have people treat me tomorrow exactly the way I treated people today." And when I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will hold me in good stead. It keeps me from flipping people off on the freeway. I still count, but I don't announce the number of items and the guy in front of me in the 10-item or less line. And I don't live my life so much out of virtue as I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight. I challenge you to use it. It will change your life. And step 12 is the greatest gift you've ever given me, an opportunity to take a little of my past, give it to another alcoholic, and say, "Honey, come with me, sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous." You don't have to live that way a day at a time. That old man that told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk, that old guy that I thought was shooting heroin, I have to tell you that he was sober longer than I'd been alive. And the reason that he nodded out in meetings is he had something inside that I didn't have a clue as to what it was. He had a serenity and a peace inside. He was right with God, he was right with himself, and he was right with us. I had absolutely no clue as to what that was. As a result of taking the 12 steps to recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, as a result of using 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis and allowing me the privilege of sitting with you, I can tell you tonight that I have nodded out in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a serenity and a peace inside. I'm right with you. I'm right with me. And for the first time in my life, I'm right with a very gentle and a very loving God. I came here to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. And if I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. If a single day in the last 30 years I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. There's a God that has a plan for me beyond my wildest imagination. I have a really wild imagination. Beyond my wildest imagination, there's a plan for me. My job, it seems, is to not drink, show up, and live life to the fullest, and turn my attention to you and see what it is that I can add to life. And when I'm doing that, God takes care of me in a way that I can't even describe. I'm going to end with the story that puts it all together for me. It's the story of the man that goes to see St. Peter, and he asks St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. And St. Peter takes him to a room, and it says hell on the door. And they open the door, and the guy's surprised because when he looks inside, it's like a banquet. Tables and tables and tables of food, as much food as you could ever want, any kind of food you could ever imagine. But amongst all that food, the people in that room were starving, they were dying, and they were hungry. And the reason was is they had those long wooden spoons tied to their hands, and the spoons were just a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. And so they sat amongst plenty, and they were starving. And that's how I was before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was out there amongst plenty, and I was starving. They took him to a room marked heaven, and that room was the same thing, tables and tables and tables of food, as much food as you could ever imagine, any kind of food that you'd ever want. And the people in that room had those long spoons tied to their arms, too. And the spoons were just a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. But the people in that room were happy, and they were full, and they were content. And the difference was is that one man was taking a spoonful of food, and he was feeding the man across the table. And he was taking a spoonful of food and feeding the person next to him, and she was feeding somebody else. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. I don't have my own answers. I have to come here, and I have to let you feed me. And every once in a while, if I'm lucky, I get to give a spoonful of this thing to another alcoholic. And you don't have to have 30 years or 20 years or 10 years or 5 years. If you have one day, you have something to feed to the man or woman coming through the door. If you have one day, you have courage to give to your person on your right, and you have strength to give to the person on your left. And we can do what I can't together. We can give each other the courage and strength that we need to continue to choose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was 4 days sober, an old man told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. And if I didn't get drunk, my life would get different, and he didn't lie to me. And I end with this. I always end with it. I end with it because it's my experience, and I pray, God, it's your experience. It's a line in chapter 5 that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.